yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Number the Stars. Hannah Coulter. The Book Thief. All the Light We Cannot See. Captain America. Thin Red Line. Saving Private Ryan. Dunkirk. Hacksaw Ridge. Atonement. Schindler's List. Valkyrie. Inglourious Bastards. We tell stories of the world wars over and over again in modern culture. In my lifetime, it seems like every year we have a blockbuster movie celebrating either the bravery of some great World War II hero or the quiet faithfulness of someone who made it through the war with hope. I just watched the Guernsey Literary Potato Peel Pie Society, which is quite a mouthful, and it struck me that besides that one, we've also had several other movies within the last just 2 years alone, thinking about Hacksaw Ridge and Dunkirk and Wonder Woman, that have had World War II as kind of their central event. It seems like we are fascinated, one could even say fixated, on this time in history. Tom Brokaw famously called the generation that survived World War II the greatest generation and heralded them for their ingenuity and their bravery, making it through the war. But as I thought about it, it struck me as kind of strange that we return to this central event over and over again to tell stories. It's not exactly an entertaining or happy period of time. It's estimated that between 60 and 80 million people died during World War II. That would cover the entire population of the United Kingdom today. It was an era of unprecedented and widespread suffering and evil. Of course, there's always been darkness and evil and wars in the world, but never before, starting with World War I, had this level of suffering been seen in such a widespread way involving so many countries. Why, then, is it this war that we return to over and over and over again for our blockbuster stories, for the myths that we love best, for the children's books, for goodness sakes? What is it about the world wars that we feel the necessity to tell the story of over and over? But I have a theory about why we tell this story again and again. And it's this. I think that lurking in the back of all of our hearts and minds is this fear that when pressed to the very edge, if there was evil everywhere, everyone would capitulate. That at the end of the day, darkness might really reign. That when push came to shove, evil really might be stronger than goodness. But I think the reason that we tell these stories is because we want to say, can goodness, can light, can hope really survive, even in the darkest of times? It reminds me of a scene in Batman, The Dark Knight, which is one of my favorite films. It's directed by Christopher Nolan. And there's this character that has done everything he can to be good, to fight evil, but he loses everything. He experiences real chaos and evil. And it causes him to think that really goodness can't survive evil. He says to Batman, "You thought we could be decent men in an indecent time, but you were wrong. The world is cruel, and the only morality in a cruel world is chance." Now, I think this is the fear that we have. And I think the reason that we tell these stories to ourselves about World War II over and over again is partially so we can convince ourselves and so that we can prepare ourselves to believe that no matter what comes, we can be decent men in indecent times. And that is the topic that we will explore today. We'll be looking at why we tell these stories of World War II over and over again. And while I think that Harvey Dent's question is one that, of course, we all face, I think there's a different way of understanding it. It's from a quote by St. Francis of Assisi. He says, "All the darkness in the world cannot extinguish the light of a single candle." We tell these stories to affirm that reality and also to prepare ourselves to be people who are those single lights in the world of darkness. So today we'll be exploring this question, why do we tell these stories over and over again? We will explore these questions through a piece of literary, a piece of visual, and a piece of musical art. The first example we'll be looking at is a literary, and we'll say that we tell these stories over and over again to begin to understand them. To do this, we'll be comparing the poetry of Lawrence Binyon with Wilfred Owen. We will talk about the tension between glorifying war and honoring war heroes. The next example will be visual. We'll be looking at Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk and exploring the idea that we tell ourselves these stories again and again to believe that there will always be groups of good people, even in the face of great evil, and there will always be groups of people who respond to evil with goodness. And then finally, we'll be looking at the iconic film score, Schindler's List, composed by John Williams. With this example, we'll be exploring the idea that even amidst great evil, one person can bring great goodness. I'm so excited to share this week with you all. I know that it's sort of a heavy topic, but I think it's also a hopeful one. So I hope you are as encouraged by listening to this podcast as I was by preparing it. Now, before we dive in, I want to remind you all about a couple of things. The first is that I want to issue a huge thank you to everyone who has supported me on Patreon. We're up to 65 patrons now, which is far exceeded my expectations. And for anyone who doesn't know what that is, the Patreon is a way for you to get more out of the podcast, and then also for me to be supported to be able to do it. As many of you know, I am a PhD student at the University of St. Andrews, and it takes a lot of time to record these podcasts, but now that I have a Patreon, I feel like I can consider it my job and my duty to create interesting content for you all. So as a thank you for everyone who supports the Patreon, that's $10 a month, they get numerous secret podcasts. So this month we'll have an interview with my sister who just released her book, Book Girl, about cultivating your soul through literature. But also you'll have a podcast from me about Gerard Manley Hopkins and his poetry and the role of romanticism with religion. And so you'll get a whole bunch of little extra things like that. There's a newsletter, there's a featured artist, you'll get downloads from musical artists and visual artists. So I try to kind of give a thank you for those who support me. So if that's something you'd be interested in, check out patreon.com/joyclarkson. I also want to share with you all that next week, well, rather in 2 weeks, I will be doing a podcast with my good friend David Bennett, and I'm really excited about that, so I hope you'll tune in. We'll be talking about feasting and fasting and desire, and it will be great fun. He's a good friend, and we spent a lot of time feasting, not a lot of time fasting, so tune in then and be ready for that episode. Another thing is that it really helps me when you all rate and review this podcast on iTunes. It helps others get to it, so please, if you feel led, go do that. Finally, please find me on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. I always love hearing from you. And if you ever have any questions or topics you'd like to hear about, please email me at thejoinusthebrave@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. So without further ado, let's dive into the meat of this week's episode, exploring the prevalence of the world wars and popular art, and asking the question, can we truly be decent people and in decent times? Let me tell you a story. I am 19 years old and have just come across the sea to do a study abroad at Oxford University. It's a crisp November morning and no one else is in the communal kitchen. I get my piece of toast and my cup of tea and I rush out the door, about to be late for church. I push open the ancient doors of the church to see a quieter and more somber crowd than usual. They're all wearing their coats because it's chilly outside, and affixed to the front of all of their coats are little red poppies, and a few with white poppies. We go through, we sing the songs, we pray the prayers, and then an unexpected part of the service comes. The priest says, "Now we will remember the fallen." And as if conducted by a secret spell, everyone fell silent. For a whole minute, no one spoke. You think of a minute as a fairly short amount of time, but when no one's speaking, it feels heavy and long. You hear every wrestling child. You see every person scratching their ear. Those 60 seconds were silent but full. And then, once the 60 seconds were spent, we all read this aloud together. "They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them." At After the service, I found out that it was Memorial Sunday, the day in the United Kingdom where they remember the fallen from World War I. I was struck by the vividness with which we had remembered those soldiers who had died in a war that ended nearly 100 years before. There is nothing in the States I could compare it to, but I thought with reverence that truly, all these years past, we did still remember them. The piece you just heard was They Are at Rest, a poem by John Henry Newman, set by John Elgar, dedicated to the fallen of those in World War I. Now, I wanted to tell you all that story because it stuck out to me in my mind as a moment when I realized that the World Wars, both the First World War and the Second World War, are much more vivid in the historical and cultural memory of the United Kingdom, and indeed of Europe in general, than they are in America. And of course, this makes sense because the wars actually happened on their land. It destroyed parts of London and it was much more present, and honestly, they lost a lot more than they did in America. But it also brought something else to me. It made me think that the way that we remember things makes a difference in how we understand them. And this really came to bear when I looked up the poet who wrote the stanza that we all said together. And it's a poem by a poet named Lawrence Binyon. And as I looked it up, I began to realize there was actually quite a bit of controversy around the poetry of World War I. And one of the major questions which really came prominently out right after World War I was, how do we tell this story? And my curiosity about this actually led me to write one of my very first papers at Oxford about Wilfred Owen, who is another war poet that we'll talk about in just a bit, because I wanted to look at what people in immediately after World War I were kind of saying and how they wanted to shape their remembrance of the wars based on the poetry and art they created. And the central tension that kind of came up in these controversies was the question of honoring the dead, so it was honoring the heroes, but then not glorifying war, because the men who were coming back from World War I, it was just dreadful. In many ways, it was actually much more damaging to England, to their troops and their men, they call it the Lost Generation, than World War II was. But the people who lived through that said, I don't want you to write fantastical, heroic poetry about me. This was a waste of a war. So you have this kind of tension between Binyon and Wilfred Owen. So we're going to explore that. And looking at the fact that part of the reason that we tell these stories of World War I and World War II over and over again is simply to make sense of them, and that the way that we make sense of them makes a difference for how we approach the future and how we understand what it was that happened in these wars. So to embark on this, we're going to first look at Lawrence Binyon's poem and kind of the way that he conceived of the war, and then we'll look at Wilfred Owen's and talk about kind of the tensions between these two. Let's begin with Lawrence Binyon's For the Fallen. Now, this is the poem from which I read you an excerpt that we read at the service. And every service I've been to over the last few years living in the UK, they always read at least that stanza, or there's two other stanzas that usually you read together. But originally, this was published as, I believe it was seven stanza, and it was published in 1914 in the London Times. So this is actually kind of at the beginning of the war. This was written specifically to remember and to commemorate the casualties from the Battle of Mons and the Battles of Marne, which were basically the opening phase of the Western Front. So that was where the most men were lost. And let me just go ahead and read you some of the rest of the poem, because that will help us kind of compare it later when we look at Wilfred Owen's poem. With proud thanksgiving, a mother for her children, England mourns for her dead across the sea. Flesh of her flesh they were, spirit of her spirit, fallen in the cause of the free. Solemn the drums thrill, death, august and royal, sing sorrow up immortal spheres. There is music in the midst of desolation and a glory that shines upon our tears. They went with songs to the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end, against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall not grow old, as we that are left to grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. They mingle not with their laughing comrades again. They sit no more at familiar tables of home. They have no lot in our labor of the daytime. They sleep beyond England's foam. But where our desires are and our hopes profound, felt as a wellspring that is hidden from sight, to the innermost heart of their own land they are known, as the stars are known to the night. As the stars that shall be bright when we are dust, moving in marches upon the heavenly plain, as the stars that are starry in the time of our darkness, to the end, they remain. So let's just chat a bit about this poem.
Perhaps the first thing to note is that it was hugely influential, which is of course evidenced by the fact that it's still used and has been used in every memorial service that I've been in the last 4 years. It was also set to music for an orchestra by Edward Elgar, who also composed the piece that we heard over the story that I told. So it's hugely influential on British culture, and those words immediately bring to mind kind of an image, a patriotic feeling, and years down the line, it still has an influence.
Now, it's interesting because it sounds, by all accounts, that Bunyan, who was older at this point, and it's important to note that Lawrence Bunyan was not actually in the war. At this point, I think he would have been in his 50s or late 40s. But he was really moved and sad about the deaths that he was hearing. And so what he does in this poem is he tries to kind of give honor to their death by saying it was worth it. You know, he says, they're fallen in the cause of the free. And he does all these things to kind of make their death seem like the hero's death. He talks about a death august and royal. So that means that it's this really kind of noble death. And he says there's a glory that shines upon our tears. So without being uncharitable, it seems a bit like he's trying to kind of make the most of this sorrow, right? And, you know, we always kind of almost make fun of the terrible trite things that people try to say when someone's lost someone. So, you know, if someone loses a child, we say, oh, God has another angel in heaven, which of course is a terrible thing to say, and you should never say that to someone that has lost a child. But that's kind of a stereotype. But he kind of almost does that when he says, he basically says, they will be like the stars that shine in heaven. So it's kind of like, oh, our boys have died, but they've died a good and august death, and they are like the stars in heaven. To the end, they remain. So they'll be, you know, God just needed another star in the sky, is kind of what he's saying. And of course, you can understand kind of the idea behind this. He wants the mothers, the sisters, the fathers, the brothers, the grandfathers and grandmothers to have a sense of the nobility of their son's death, that they didn't die in vain, that they were worth it, they were loved. And so he writes this poem. But I want to compare this quickly with another poem, which, as I said, did not become popular until much, much later. And this is by Wilfred Owen. Now, to give you a preface, Wilfred Owen, unlike Lawrence Bunyan, was in the war. So he joined when he was 19, and he really struggled. He was injured at one point and had to go back. He suffered from shell shock and I think from concussions. He was really badly injured. And he was really disoriented with war. But while he was healing, he met with this other war poet named Sassoon. And Sassoon saw that he was a really talented poet, and he said, you need to write about the war. But the way that Wilfred Owen writes about the war is so different from Bunyan, because, you know, Bunyan is writing, he says, you know, we have glory in our tears. And Wilfred Owen did not want to see the glory and the tears and the death. So one of his most famous poems is one called Dulce et Decorum Est, which is Latin for it is sweet and good. And this is from a Latin poem that says Dulce et Decorum Est pro patria mori, which means it is sweet and good to die for one's country. And when he's saying this, he's really referencing a lot of the things like Bunyan's poem, a lot of the the kind of World War I campaigns centered around this, because people felt like there was a lot of loss, but they needed to think that the loss meant something. And so a lot of what we saw coming out of the government was things actually referencing this poem, because, you know, a lot of young schoolboys were learning Latin, and that was in their, you know, what they were learning as young kids, so they would have known this. And so this was this way of saying, you know, death is sad, but it's good and sweet to die for your country. So he wrote this poem, and I just want you to think about it as in contrast with Binion.
I will give this disclaimer. If you are sensitive to kind of graphic or violent content, I would say just skip the next about minute and a half, and then you can skip straight to my commentary, if that is what would make you feel more comfortable, which I would support.
But for those who are ready, this is the contrast to Binion's. It reads, "Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed, coughing like hags, we curse through sludge, till on the haunting flares we turn our backs, and towards our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep, many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshot. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of gas shells dropping softly behind. Gas, gas, quick, boys! An ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man on fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light, and under a green sea I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning, and if in some smothering dreams you could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face and his hanging face like a devil's sack of sick of sin. If you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud, of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to the children, ardent for some desperate glory, the old lie. Dulce et decorum est. Pro patria mori." So these two poems could not be more different. What Owen is doing here, I think what I've come to think is that he's actually telling, you know, he had shell shock, which is what we would call now post-traumatic distress disorder. And that was not, people didn't know what to do with it. And part of it was because, I mean, I think people had had it before. There have always been wars, but they saw it in mass. It's crazy. I was at a Tolkien exhibit recently in Oxford, and they had a picture of all of his young classmates, like when he first went to Oxford. And in his freshman year, Tolkien was called out of Oxford, as many were, and was put to the war, as were most of his comrades. And in this picture, they then showed the amount of people that survived from his class, and it was shocking. It was maybe one in seven survived. And that was because they took a lot of these young men who were like the promising people at Oxford and made them in charge of whole battalions of men. So that's what Wilfred Owen is responding to. He's responding to
the huge loss. You know, they know that about one in every 45 people in England died during the war, and most of those were young men. And when you consider the small percentage of the population of those young men would have been, you realize that they lost almost an entire generation. And they call that generation the lost generation.
And Wilfred Owen was a part of that. And so he saw all these people who were like him, who were young men who were, as he says at the end, ardent for some desperate glory. And he felt like the ways that they were trying to get men into the war were glorifying the violence and the kind of nonsense of war. So you have these two kind of ways of looking. You have the one hand, the man who's trying to make the mothers feel like their sons died for a good cause. And then on the other hand, you have Wilfred Owen, who's saying, do not tell young men this lie that just going to war is good. And it's interesting because shortly after the war, people like Binion were much more popular. So if you're just going to ask somebody on the street, actually, this would probably not be a good question to ask somebody on the street, because I think most people know the answer. But if you were to ask someone, like, who do you think of as a World War I poet? People now will say Wilfred Owen. But closer to World War I, they definitely would have said someone like Binion, Sassoon to a certain extent, but even he was recognized more later. And that's because shortly after World War I, they just kind of wanted to say, it was good, like, that was terrible, but our men died, it was honorable, we're thankful for them, we all are free now, and that was the war to end all wars. But Wilfred Owen became more popular years and years after his death. He died in the trenches, which is really tragic. He became more popular in the 40s and 50s, after it was proven that that war wasn't the war to end all wars, and they had a Second World War. And there was this sense of kind of, ugh, like, again, all this loss, all of this pain, and what does it mean? And I think that really shows that that the way we tell the story kind of begins to shape how we feel about it. And by the Second World War, they felt like the story that was being told by people like Binion wasn't really true anymore. They felt like that doesn't sufficiently get to how we feel about this war. And so what do we do, though? Because on the one hand, you don't want to be so pessimistic that you just say, oh, well, you know, it's all meaningless, which is kind of what you feel like Wilfred Owen wanted to do, even though he fought voluntarily to his death. But neither does it feel like Binion's picture really captures, you know, the struggles and terribleness that we saw in the war. So what do we do? And I think that for me, this is kind of solved, not solved, but is much more accurately captured, the kind of attitude, the way that we need to tell these stories, was better told through J.R.R. Tolkien in a letter to his son. So Tolkien had been, as I said, he had been in the World War I, he'd been in the front lines, and two of his three best friends died in World War I. And in World War II, when this is happening again, and Tolkien had two sons, he wrote to his son, he said this, "I do find all this mighty hard to bear. The utter stupid waste of war, not only material, but moral and spiritual. It's so staggering to those of us who have endured it, and always was, despite the poets, and always will be, despite the propagandists. Not, of course, that it has not been, and is, and always will be necessary to face in an evil world." So, what I find interesting about this is that Tolkien, he kind of does a bit of both. And this, you feel like he's more on the side of Wilfred Owen. He's saying, no, war is such a waste, it's such a sign of a broken and fallen world. But he also recognizes that it is, to a certain extent, this kind of thing that will always happen. And to me, when I look at his books, I see them as being profoundly shaped by having lived in a lifetime with two world wars. And when you look at the characters that are in his books, they're always characters who are on the edge of doom, for whom being good, fighting, hoping may not make a difference. But they always decide to, nonetheless.
Tolkien's books did not shy away at all from war, from evil, from suffering. I mean, heaven's sakes, The Lord of the Rings is about the ultimate conquering of Middle-earth by an evil force. He doesn't shy away from us, but he teaches us something else.
We learn from him that we should not, in trying to celebrate, as we rightly should, the heroes of war, elevate war itself. War and evil will always be part of our experience in a fallen and broken world. But what we need is not to glorify war, but instead to learn how to be brave and how to be humane within it. We need to learn to kind of defy Harvey Dent to say that it is possible to be a decent man in decent times, and to prepare ourselves for that.
Now, before we move on, I want to heartily suggest to you that you should read Tolkien and the Great War by John Garth, which I found was a really encouraging kind of depiction of the ways in which the First World War did shape Tolkien, but it also shaped him in coming to believe that though there will always be darkness in the world, there always have to be people who fight for good, almost irrationally. A people who fight for hope because they truly believe that darkness will never finally and ultimately win. So now that we've started by thinking about the ways in which how we remember these stories of World War I and World War II shape how we understand them and how we move forward, kind of both rejecting the totally pessimistic no one's heroism matters, but also rejecting the glorification of war, let's look forward to look at two other examples of war in popular culture and in art, seeing how one of them teaches us that we want to believe and cling on to the idea that in every dark circumstance, there will always be groups of people who will choose to be brave, and that we want to prepare ourselves to be a part of that motley crew. And then second of all, that even when all is dark, the light of one person choosing to be righteous can make a huge difference. It's May 26, 1940. 338,000 troops from the Allied forces are stuck on the beaches of Dunkirk. They're sitting ducks, ready to be eviscerated by the Nazis. King George declares it a national day of prayer, hoping that somehow, some way, their plan to evacuate as many of the soldiers as possible will work. And the crazy thing is, it did. But it wasn't any normal military evacuation. It came to be known as the Miracle of Dunkirk, and was, by the end of it, reckoned to be the largest military evacuation ever in history. 338,226 soldiers were evacuated between May 26th and June 4th, 1940. You would think that this might have happened on huge military boats, and while many of the soldiers did go on those huge military boats, many of them went on 700, quote, small boats. These things ranged from anything from fishermen's boats to small yachts to little skiffs. Basically, what happened was that the government put out a call and said, if you are able, if you have a boat, come to Dunkirk. And at great risk to their own safety, 700 boats from the UK went to save these soldiers. And miraculously, it did work. The successful evacuation of Dunkirk was a huge boon to the morale of the United Kingdom. It was a picture of what Britain was, or at least of what they wanted it to be, of 700 fishermen risking their lives to do the right and noble thing. For an army that was feeling beaten back and already losing, it gave them strength to go on. Famously, Winston Churchill gave a speech that is burned into the cultural history of the United Kingdom. He said this,
"We shall fight in France, we shall fight on the seas and oceans, we shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air, we shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender."
And that is the story that Christopher Nolan told in his recent movie, Dunkirk. It really is sort of a miraculous story. One of those things you look back on and can't believe that it actually happened in history. Now, Joel, my composer brother, would have my head if I didn't tell you that the theme playing behind me was from Dunkirk, but it's also a playing on Elgar's Nimrod variations. He had many different versions of this, but it is classic and it goes along with the Remembrance Day, so he's kind of connecting World War I to World War II. And as you'll notice, we've already had 3 mentions of Elgar this episode. That was unintentional. So with that little musical I spy aside, let's go ahead and talk about the movie, which, by the way, is sort of a difficult movie. It's not as violent as it could be. I think he kind of stayed away from that. But if you're not into war movies, just take my word for this discussion and you can move right along. I went to see this movie last summer, I suppose it was, with a whole bunch of friends in St. Andrews. And it was funny because I went to see it with one of my good gal friends and then 2 of our guy friends. And both of the guys came out of the movie just like overwhelmed by wanting to be here. It touched some deep part of their spirits that made them want to be heroes, want to go out and fight and give their lives for something that mattered. And something that one of my friends said really made this kind of what is compelling about the story clear to me, which was he said, you know, I want to be good. I want to be good so much. I want to give my life to something that matters. And then it was so clear there was an evil, and to be good was to overcome the evil and to help people that were overcoming it. And he said, what's confusing to me now is that I have the desire to give my life to something good. He said, I would give up all my life. I would die for something if I only knew what it was. And he said, and it's so hard in our world to know what thing one should give one's life up for. And that may sound funny, but I think I know what he means. There was this kind of uncomplicated nature to the evil of World War II. I think we can all agree that Nazism as a movement was evil. It was prejudicial. It was cruel. And so the clear and right kind of way to be brave was to fight the evil of Nazism or to support those who did. Now, when you compare that with now, I think part of the reason that we end up telling these stories is because everybody has that impulse, I think, to want to give their lives to something great. But it seems kind of complicated right now. It feels like there's no place where it's just so clear there's an evil that you can give yourself to conquering. And I think people feel like, whether it's in politics, that both sides have all of these kind of hang-ups and issues, and one can't feel clear giving yourself there. And then there's all of these disappointing things, whether it's in church or whether it's here or whether it's there. There's this sense that there's no place to go where you can be uncomplicatedly heroic. So I think that part of the reason that we tell this story is because we just long to give our lives to something that is good, and we long for that good to be uncomplicated. And what's interesting is that the wars following that, especially for America, were so complicated. You know, you think about Vietnam and Korea, and then you think about the kind of endless confusion of the Gulf War, and then our wars with Iraq. There was never this sense that they were totally right or that they were totally effective. So I think that part of the reason that we long for and that we find connection with these stories, stories like Dunkirk, is that they're really satisfying to our heroic mindsets. They're satisfying because there's a clear good and a clear evil, and there's a clear role that we can live into if we want to be the brave people. And it's not just a story about brave individuals. It's not just a story about brave heroes. It's about many people coming to be good. It's about kind of testing a culture and finding that many people, when pressed, were willing to do the right thing. And I think we really long for that. But I wonder if there's a danger in that. I think we can begin to romanticize the simple evil of that time, not realizing that evil has always been complicated and being good has always been complicated. And I think that Christopher Nolan actually shows this really well in his film, because what he centers around is not kind of an idealized heroism, but a moment-by-moment pressing survival mode. He shows that even in those moments when we are basically just fighting for our life, you still see the ways that people's goodness, their choices, their heroism, and really just their blunt strength, their desire to keep going, can be shown. And I think what that helps us see is that not every soldier was brave, not every moment was easy. We shouldn't idealize the pain and suffering and great violence of World War II just because it gives us a clear enemy. Rather, we should realize that evil is always complicated and being good is always complicated, but just like the heroes who moment by moment chose to be good, we too need to learn to master our wills. So what do we do as we long for heroism in a world in which everything feels complicated? I think the first thing I would say is not to over-idealize that time. The things that people lost going through World War II are things that I would never have to suffer. And we don't want to, kind of in our naivety, idealize a time that was really difficult and violent. We can enjoy the heroism and praise that, but let's not over-idealize the pain and suffering. But I think the other thing I would say is that maybe we need to start thinking differently about what it looks like to be brave as groups in our day. Maybe the forces that we're fighting at the moment aren't as clear in a physical present way as Nazism spreading across Europe was. But I think sometimes the things that are really threatening our world are kind of more invisible sources. My mom always calls it the Cold War of the modern age. So it's this sense of presiding cynicism, of disconnection and isolation. Compromise, whether that's morally or religiously or personally, this kind of just giving in to the malaise of the complicatedness of modern life. I think that these are the three things that are kind of lapping up on our shore, the things that would threaten to take us out in the same way that the Nazis were going to take the people on Dunkirk. So what does it look like when you think about that as your enemy? What would it look like to be the single candle that can't be extinguished in that kind of world? If you were to imagine yourself as one of those little fishermen, how would you take your boat to fight the despair, cynicism, anger, hatred, ignorance, isolation, and discord in our world? After thinking about it for a while, I came to the conclusion that I don't think that evil has ever been uncomplicated. I think the world has always been difficult. So our question is, as Tolkien would put it, what we must do with the times that are given us. So don't waste time idealizing the heroes of the past. Rather, learn from their example and respond to the evils of your time with unceasing energy. And remember, that when many people choose to do that, just as the many people in the boats went out to save Dunkirk, true miracles can happen, and they have. Dunkirk came about because 800 people said, yes, I will use my small boat. It makes me think of the parable, the event in Jesus' life when the kid gave the fishes and the loaves and he made it enough. People's willingness to be heroic is enough, but you have to be willing and you have to say yes. But sometimes we become discouraged. What if we're not surrounded by 800 other boats? What if we are the only one that goes to save all the soldiers on the beach? And that leads us to our next example, which is a musical example of Schindler's List by John Williams. They called them Schindlerjuden, or Schindler's Jews, 1,200 Polish Jews who were saved by the bravery of German national Oskar Schindler. Schindler's story began inauspiciously, and he didn't show any great signs of bravery to begin with. He was a German national, a spy for the Abwehr, and he was part of the Nazi Socialist Party. But perhaps more than all of this, he was a businessman who cared most about making money. And when he realized that the Jews were being used for very cheap labor, he began to use some of them in his enamelware factory. So that's anything that has to do with metal, so it could have been used for artillery and things during the war. So he began employing Jews at his factory. Now, he didn't have any conscience about this. There wasn't anything bothering him about it. He was a part of the Nazi Socialist Party. But somewhere along the way, once they started to empty the ghettos, he began to see unspeakable cruelty, and something in him flipped. He recognized that there was something wrong about this. And so, that began his mission to save the Jews in his factory. He found out that some of them were going to be sent off to one of the death camps, and he did everything in his power to keep them in his factory. Through connections, through conniving, through using his own money to bribe people, he managed to keep 1,200 people safe. Inside his factory, he encouraged them to celebrate the Sabbath. He provided them with food and shelter. And perhaps most importantly, he did everything in his power to keep them out of the hands of the famously sadistic MN Goth. By the end of the war, 2 days before it ended, he had spent all of his considerable wealth on bribes to keep these people safe. Miraculously, it seems, the 1,200 Jews did survive. It's another one of those stories like Dunkirk, in that it seems like a miraculous beam of light in the midst of much great suffering and peril. It was this story that Steven Spielberg brought to light in the famous movie Schindler's List, based on the novel Schindler's Ark. Now, this has several kind of striking features as a film. It was filmed in black and white, is deeply violent. It was nominated for 12 Oscars and won 5, which is a huge amount. And it's a really important movie. Now, I have to tell you that I have not seen this movie, and I don't think that I ever can, because I am really sensitive to these stories, and it's enough moving me simply to think about it. So, do as you will. I'm sure many of you have watched it, but what I wanted to focus on was the story and the way in which John Williams brought the aching beauty of the story to life in his iconic film score. Now, this is one of the most recognizable film scores because the theme is so haunting and beautiful. But what's interesting about it is that it has this mixture between being an absolute aching song that sounds like, it sounds like a mourning, it sounds like someone longing for someone who they can't get back, but then also having these moments of surprising resolution. I noticed when I listened back through this that in the short preamble before the theme comes in, it resolves in a surprising way. It sounds aching, all of a sudden it resolves and then goes in to the theme. And I think that's significant because what Williams is having to do as he composes this piece is musically tell us a story that that cannot be glossed over. It is wonderful that 1,200 Jews were saved because of Schindler's bravery. And now they say that 6,600 of the relatives and children of Schindler Juden live in the U.S. and Israel. And that's incredible. The fact that his bravery made that happen. But there's nothing that can wipe out the suffering and the pain and the darkness of the other thousands and millions of people who were not saved. And we look at Schindler and we see the power of one person doing everything in his power to save these people. And it's incredible, but we're also struck by the fact that that should have been every person. Every person should have given all that they had to not allow others to be harmed, others to be hurt. And so we have this tension between the beauty of Schindler's bravery, but also the grief of the fact that there was this darkness to begin with. And I think that that Williams really does a good job of kind of capturing this, because the song sounds like a lament, and so it should, because so many people's lives were lost. But it also has these moments of transcendent beauty. And to me, that's kind of the question of Schindler's life, and really of the World War II in general. What do we do about the fact that there are these moments of utter beauty and bravery, but it's amidst great, unimaginable sorrow? What do we do with that? I think that in some ways, this story gets to the more cosmic questions that World War II caused us to ask than any of the other stories. Because when we look from the British side, it's easy to celebrate the wars, kind of, you know, saying this was a moment when there was a clear evil and, you know, all the Allied forces were able to conquer it. And that is a good thing in the sense that it's a time when there was a clear evil that you could clearly fight on the right side of. But I think what is the more fundamental and difficult question that really began to shape the rest of Western society and Western even theology, I see this totally in studying theology, was the question of how can you even speak of good when there's so much evil? What do we even make of that? What do we mean by God making everything right? Can God really make everything right when there's been so much evil undone? Does Schindler's one decision for goodness somehow repay or make okay the darkness that we see? And then when that comes into our own lives, we can say all day that we should fight and be good, that we should be our own little boat trying to do the best that we can and bring light and hope and joy. But in the sea of kind of isolation, if we think of a world that feels like it's overwhelmed by evil, if we're in the world that has already capitulated to evil, because I think that's what he was in, what do we do then? Does our little argument make any difference? Does our little attempt to save make any difference? And I think that there's two things to answer this with. The one is that certainly we cannot look at Schindler's life and say that his one small struggle or great struggle didn't make a huge difference. It did. We see 6,600 living heirs of the people that he saved, and that is remarkable. So I think on the one hand, this story tells us that one person's faithfulness, the one boat going towards Dunkirk, does make a difference, and that we should never give up on that. We should never give in to the idea that we just shouldn't try to be brave, we shouldn't try to fight the battles of our day because it won't make a difference. It always makes a difference. It is always a spot of brightness in a history of darkness. But when we feel like we are the one ship in the middle of the ocean surrounded by bombers that are going to take us out, and when we look at Schindler, who saved 1,200 but still felt inadequate because he couldn't save thousands, what do we do then? What do we do when the battle just feels too exhausting, like we will always fight and there will always be another evil to overcome? So, on the one hand, a very practical thing to say to this is that there always will be evil to overcome, and I'd rather live in a good world than a bad one. But this also becomes unsatisfying at some level, because the reality is that someday I will die, and then I will have spent my whole life fighting for a better world, only to die. What good is it? Why shouldn't we just give in to the evil? And that sounds rather depressing, but that's actually kind of what began to work its way into philosophy, especially right after World War I. And even now, when I look at the accounts of theology as they shifted after World War I and then World War II, you see this kind of wrestling with evil in a way that they didn't have to before. This kind of wrestling not just with evil, but with with nihilism. How do we live good lives? Why do we live good lives? And I think this is where you have to have some vision of an eternal wholeness, something that we're fighting for beyond this life, beyond our short existences. We have to have a vision of a light beyond, so that when we see these moments, these pockets of brightness, when we see the bravery of many men at Dunkirk, or when we see the great persistence of one man, that these are representative of a further and future victory. And if they aren't, then why would we keep fighting? I want to read you this passage from one of my favorite characters, and who I think is the real hero of Lord of the Rings. Sam's answer is that there is something more fundamental than evil, and that is light. Light will always outlast darkness. There they were. And sometimes you didn't want to know the end, because how could it be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was when so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness must pass. Sam's answer to the darkness was not to deny it, but to say that light would outlast it. Tolkien believed that goodness was more fundamental than evil, that in the end, good would prevail in a great catastrophe. And it's difficult to believe that. It's difficult to see it. But I think that it's impossible for us to fight, to be good, to be virtuous, to be the one boat in the ocean, if we don't have some vision of that eternal and unstoppable redemption. Tolkien called it in one of his essays, the eucatastrophe. You know, we think about a catastrophe as something terrible happening very quickly. But he said, we tell ourselves in these stories over and over again about eucatastrophes, the good catastrophes, the sudden turn for the good. And he said, I think that's woven into the human consciousness because we desire that someday all of these good things, all the moments that people chose to do the right thing throughout history, all the moments people chose to light a candle and to not be extinguished by the darkness, these were all bearing testament to the final turn towards the good, the final eucatastrophe. Elsewhere, Tolkien describes it this way. He says, I am a Christian, so that I do not expect history to be anything but a long defeat, though it contains, and in a legend may contain more clearly and movingly, some samples or glimpses of final victory. And I think that that's kind of what we're getting and why we love some of these stories, because we see in these moments of great darkness the glimpses of that final victory. I'm sure that I have not hit upon all of the reasons why we may make stories about World War II and World War I, but I hope that today has gotten you thinking. I hope that it's gotten you thinking about how the way that we tell these stories shape the way that we understand them and the way we live. We got to explore this idea by contrasting the poetry of Bunyan and of Wilfred Owen. With Bunyan, we saw someone who, in trying to honor the heroes, ended up glorifying the war, which reminded us that we need to have a realistic perspective on these things. We can't, through our own patriotic pride, begin to cheer and enjoy the war that really brought so much suffering and decay. But at the same time, we shouldn't give in entirely to the pessimism of Wilfred Owen. Instead, we should have something in our mind like Tolkien, who saw war as a great evil, but also saw the world as our opportunity to be those moments, those glimpses of the final victory, of hope and gentleness and peace. Secondly, we saw that we tell these stories because we want to believe that even in impossible times, good people will resist evil together. As we explored this, we looked at Dunkirk and explored the ways in which it kind of brings back to us a time when there was an uncomplicated evil. But we questioned that and said there's no such thing as an uncomplicated evil, and we must be challenged to fight whatever our darkness is in our time. Finally, we looked at the idea that even when the whole world seems to be evil, we must choose to be brave and good, and to believe that our small bravery and goodness will make a difference, like it did in the life of the Schindlerjuden, in the story of Oskar Schindler, through Schindler's List, with that beautiful piece of music. We shouldn't tell stories about these wars to glorify the idea of an enemy worth hating and devouring. Rather, if we do find inspiration for them, it should be because we saw pockets of brightness and of beauty, people who chose to be good even in impossible times. People who rejected Harvey Dent and believed that it is possible to be decent men in an indecent time. But that to choose that means that we have to be able to believe that there is something beyond this eternal struggle against good and evil. Now let me end with a passage that I think tells this story much better than I can. It's from The Return of the King. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tower high up in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and hope returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach.